The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2023, Charting the Course, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join. or by making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, please visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Good day, everybody. Do I have good audio? Can you give me some feedback, please, in the chat? Yep, great. Well, it's an honor for me to be here, hosted by the FSF. Thanks Hector for the presentation. Thanks Michael. Thanks Greg. Thanks whoever else is back there helping and making this work. I'm very grateful for having the opportunity. So my first aim here is to build languages. We're not talking about programming languages. We're not talking even about language as we know it with a vocabulary. We're talking about a language in a broader sense, in the sense that in how language builds a culture, and how by building a new language, we can build and we can expand a culture which has a sense of ethics in our world, in our actual world, in our modern world, with all the technology background that is so important right now. So in that sense, I will first make a presentation that I have for, is it like an example of language of how to explain this situation which we are facing right now? Because you can ask questions whenever you like. Hector will be moderating, so please, I am very open to questions. And as this is an effort to build something, a language, which will be immensely helped by the collective genius of us all. So we're right now in a very special situation in the world, right? So something radically new is happening in the world, which has like two main elements, which is one, the global scope. We never ever before saw something that was so global and the world so small as right now with all the digital technology and high tech. We're talking about a high level and very sophisticated level of technology, you know. And the thing is that this thing is affecting society's fabric in all its level. It has a deep cultural and sociological and psychological effects. No, a lot of things are happening. There are documentaries we can see about these issues. So everything is going very fast, but the world is like reacting sometimes too late. But people are reacting, you know. We're kind of afraid, but we don't know. People don't know what to do about it much. So I think in this confusion, you know, I think a lot of the people that is right now, I suppose that a lot of the people that are in this conference, attending this conference right now, are people who are somehow involved with the Libre software movement. And some people who are kind of more techie than most of the people. So my question is, how do we, which as we have a tech base, and we have a sometimes a philosophical basis to understand the importance of this. How do we reach most of the people who don't, you know? And in this, there's confusion in the sense that technology is sometimes seen as something bad, you know. People say, okay, well, technology is bad, you know, all these things that are happening with the big corps, let's say Google, Amazon, Microsoft, whatever, you know, Instagram, psychological issues on children, on teenagers, Amazon, all the monopolies, whatever. So maybe technology is just bad, and what we need is to turn back to nature and go to in a Walden style, in a into the wild style, just get back to our roots. You know, that's one way. But the thing to be clear is to differentiate that we have good technology and we have bad technology. You know, maybe good and bad is not the best adjectives. Maybe we can say we have ethical technology and we have what we may call dystopian technology. Dystopian in the sense that it brings us to a dystopian reality, as illustrated by the famous works of George Orwell or Aldous Huxley, and or a lot of sci-fi movies, in the sense that they lead us to a humanity that is enslaved by these corporate interests. Or maybe in most of the dystopian novels, we find a government that is like a dictatorship that dictates and enslaves humanity. But in this capitalist world, it might not be a government, but it's like more corporations that make the same thing, basically. So first thing is to make this distinction to me. But this kind of abuse, this kind of reality that brings us humanity to a border of what we could say, like a very very difficult situation. Is it really new? And the thing is that maybe it's not so new. You know, maybe it's like the same thing that has been happening for centuries or for millennia, maybe. But right now there are new tools available. So as when nuclear weapons were discovered, you know, and we had to halt them and to regulate them so we don't destroy the world. So there are new tools right now happening in the digital world that give some unlimited, I don't know if unlimited, but previously unseen power to those who hold these tools. So maybe it's not that new. So the situation here, the whole situation is kind of complex, and it's not so easy to explain. You know, I have four elements which for me are very important, which is, first, this is new in the sense as, okay, we saw that abuse is not new in history, but the situations that as global and as technical as it is right now is like totally new, and we haven't had the evolutionary time maybe to get used to it. So it's that makes it difficult to understand. Then it is invisible to the naked eye. What is happening inside our computers, inside the data that's been transmitted by Wi-Fi, by optic fiber cables, you know, all the data that's transmitted through the internet use, we can't see it. You know, we're humans which have evolved in a material world. Our senses are made for relating, for interacting with this material world. So we can't see software directly, you know. We don't have the ability to look inside a computer and understand the code that is there, or the binary code that is there. So that also makes it difficult to understand for us. Maybe if we're techies and we know something, we're programmers and we know a little about computers, we can know. But for most of the people, you know, they hold their phones in their hands, and they don't have access to the reality that is happening like beneath the curtains, you know, inside their phones. It's also technically complex. So we need to understand a bit about computers. We need to understand a bit about what is source code, what is binary code, and to understand what are the dangers. And it's also multiscope, because it's not only a technical issue. It's an issue that is affecting the whole fabric of human culture and society. You know, it's affecting us culturally, socially, how we relate to each other, how we interact with each other. It's also affecting us psychologically. Now, we've seen a lot of examples about addictions and all kind of psychological illnesses that come as a consequence of the use of dystopians, specifically most of all dystopian social networks, as the mainstream ones are. And it also affects politically, we say, because we've seen, you know, there's this Cambridge Analytica, it's the most famous case in which all the data and all the information that has been gathered through the use of social networks and dystopian platforms is used for affecting political results, political elections. So, yeah, we've seen it in Chile. We've had some very interesting examples in the last a couple of years, history of Chile also in regard to this specific issue. So, how to counterweight these big capitalist corporations' lobbies and marketing efforts? They have loads of money, you know, they have loads of power to make their marketing a lobby. So how can we really tackle this? And for me, the thing is communities, you know, I can make a change myself, but there's this network effect in which it's an economical concept that I think is very important to understand, in which if we have for any product that has more value, as more users it has, is affected by the network effect. So the network effect makes that a product gets more value the bigger the user pool it has. So for example, if you have the typical example is a telephone. If you have a telephone, it could be a wonderful technology, but if nobody else has a telephone, then it has no value at all. But the relation, so if you have, for example, 5 people with telephones, then you can build 10 different interactions between these people and so on. So social networks are an excellent example of the network effect. And the network effect is one of the, as Cory Doctorow explains, the moats, like the moats around the castle, that help a monopolist castle remain, what he talks in his book, Choke Point Capitalism. One of the modes that helps this empire persist is the network effect, as there's also the data mode, and there's also the cost mode. Okay, but that I digress a little from our main issue. So this network effect, for example, if everybody's in Facebook, how can we get everybody to the Fediverse? We already have an ethical network of networks, you know, built on LibreSoftware, built on Federation, built with resilience, you know, but it's so difficult to get people there because everybody's on Facebook. And then what's first? So if I go to the Fediverse, for example, I create an account on Mastodon or on PixelFed, but there's nobody there. So maybe I'll just go back to Facebook or to Instagram or to Twitter. But if I'm not there, if I'm not in the Fediverse, then my friend who will create an account on Mastodon and will check there, will see nobody there. So what's first, the egg or the hen? You know, we need to be there in order that when people come, they see us. But it's very difficult to do these kind of things just on a personal level. We need to make this as communities. So how to get communities involved? First I will go to my presentation then. We'll make a parenthesis in this line of thought that I was giving, just to give you this example of trying to create a language to reach people and to explain our current situation with the urgency I think it deserves, by having an historical and sociological perspective, you know? Yeah, Felix is saying that he finds it very difficult for people that don't have a technical background to understand the risks of proprietary software. And that is exactly what I think is a main issue. You know, how can we explain it? It's complex, you know. For me, it's been complex to understand. And in this process of understanding, I have been researching and explaining people and giving talks, and each time it gets, I have more sense, but it's something so abstract and difficult to explain, you know. So let's get into this history. Are there any questions? I'll check the chat. No questions yet. Okay. So this is feudalism, medieval era, in which we have a castle and a feudal lord, and we have the serfs, which work for the lord. The lord has, it's kind of a monopoly and monopsony also. And for those who don't know this word monopsony, it's not a new world, a new word. It's a word that has been coined in the 30s by, I think her name is Joanne Robinson. It's quoted by Cory Doctorow on the book Choke Point Capitalism, which is a very recommended lecture. So we all know what a monopoly is. A monopoly is where you have only one entity which sells something. So this entity has the power to put any prices, you know, and to abuse the consumers. Yeah, we know that. But what is a monopsony? A monopsony is the other thing, the contrary thing. I mean, you have one entity, which is the only entity which has the power to buy from you. So if you're a producer and you sell something, and you, for example, this product requires some kind of industry or kind of machine to be transformed into the final product, and this machine is only one company has this machine, then this machine has a monopsony, and this machine can put any price they want to buy you the nuts or meat or whatever you are producing, or the mining raw material, because they're the only ones that can process this mining material. I'm sorry, I'm lacking some English vocabularies sometimes for some specific things. Yeah, we have the link for monopsony. So when we have a castle and we only can sell them, and this castle has the military power, yeah, we know of the feudal life, you know, it's a world that is, it tends to abuses, you know, logically. So, and it's a very local world. It's a world which works in, people live in a very local area. There are some travelers that sometimes travel around the world, but the world is totally local. With the Renaissance, we begin to have hold an understanding of what is a global world. And this changes the world completely. And at first, yeah, it is seen, then emerges the idea of free markets in which everybody can buy and sell. But it's a world like a few empires. We're talking about four or five European empires that start to colonize and to grab hold of the world through a lot of abuses and slaving and genocides and the extinction of whole races. So it's kind of a very ugly thing that happens. And then we begin to see the first global empires, you know, in a sense that they hold almost the whole world. The biggest extent of the Spanish Empire. And these empires begin to build a whole and complex infrastructure, which purpose, I don't know if I said that right, but the purpose of this infrastructure is to extract resources. You know, the colonies, the America, Asia, Africa have a lot of resources which have a capital value for the, have a money value, a monetary value to the empires. So how can we extract these resources? And the extraction of these resources not only requires the direct infrastructure that will extract these resources at, as I know, milling industry, whaling industry, but also the transport of it, the roads, the rails, the ports, and also the infrastructure that will give house to the people that will be in charge of this extraction industry. And that's what's that? That's cities, you know, cities and schools and hospitals and whatever. So this in the Renaissance, so we see this this extraction, digital, not digital, sorry, this colonialist extraction. So we in the this image is 19th century now, so we're like ending this colonialist era. Nations have begun to achieve independence. But what we see here, and for me is very interesting, is that the roads, the red lines that we see here, are almost the same lines that we saw on the Renaissance ship tracks, ship roads. But these are not ship roads. These are the telegraph system, you know, that for the first time, now we're talking about another level of globalization. We're not talking about the globalization in which some people travel, yes, and you will be in Spain and you will get cocoa from America, or you get, I don't know, spices from Philippines, whatever. No, this is something that connects the world almost instantly in communication, you know, and this again changes the world. So we're starting the industrial era. And this, again, almost the same lines, but this is not the ship roads, this is not the telegraph, these are the internet subway, internet submarine cables, which are property of just a few companies that own this. That's a section of the cable. So there's Shoshana Zuboff. Shoshana Zuboff has a book, a very interesting book, and she coined the term surveillance capitalism. And she has in this book The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. And that's, for example, that's creation of a language. You know, that's very interesting because she manages to, something's happening here, you know, I don't feel very comfortable, something's happening with this whole digital thing, something doesn't smell good, I'm seeing abuses, I'm seeing something invisible that people is not noticing, but that's making harm on our society. Whoop. And she grabbed and she made this concept, surveillance capitalism. So it's very interesting to explain. These are extracts from a comic, which is called contrachrome.com, I think, from Leah Elliott. We made a video a while ago about this comic. It's a very good effort that explains the dangers of Google's Chrome browser and how it's basically a surveillance tool. You know, yeah, Google Chrome gives you some uses, you know, it's useful for us, you know, to check websites whatsoever. But the main purpose of Google Chrome is not being useful to you. The main purpose of it is extracting data from you and in order to sell it or to monetize it somehow. There's the link to Contrachrome. Thanks, Felix. So I recommend that Contrachrome comics. Very, very good. That's also that Contrachrome comic is also an example of a very good language to give, you know. And this kind of things are like little chips, little capsules of information that if we manage to to instaurate this capsules of information in our culture, in our language, we might have a good achieving society's conscious about these issues. So she's right now talking about the metadata or shadow text, which is not the text we because there's the text we directly write into a Google search, for example, or we on a Facebook post, whatever, but there's also the shadow text, which is text that that we don't see, but they see about our uses. How often do we use it? What do we search? Who do we talk with? What we search after doing something? How long do we keep the telephone open? Whatever. And all this data is kind of, it might sound superfluous to us, like, how does it have so much value? I mean, who cares about if I open WhatsApp for 10 minutes or 5 minutes? You know, it's, that doesn't make any sense. But the fact, and this is another thing that is very difficult for us to comprehend, is that this is in 2017, The Economist publishes this this issue of its magazine, in which data markets all the transactions in billions of dollars of all this private data of people surpassed the transactions of oil markets. That's something huge, you know. That's it's very difficult to comprehend because it's invisible. You know, we used to see trains with wagons full of ore to refine in the colonist extraction, you know, but we could also see pipes of oil, you know, and oil rigs, but we don't see the, we see our phone with Google, with Facebook, whatever, but we don't see the data trafficking that's behind that, you know. So we have a question there. Do you see a way right now? Oh, Hector, you want to read this question?
Yes, thank you. I have a question. It is, do you see a way right now to build a sort of decentralized world? I mean, like a world not controlled by anyone in particular, but at the same time, controlled by everyone. I mean, a system that doesn't give too much persistent power to one entity, or a system that makes easy to change power without like dramatic side effects or something. That is like the idea of the question. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that's a huge question, you know. That's a huge question. Yeah, I mean, I think right now there's like a struggle in the world because, yeah, we're into the digital platforms, we're into the software issue, you know, but the struggle in the world is also beyond the software issue, of course. The software issue is having like a dramatic importance right now because software is everywhere, you know, it's reaching every part of our life, so it has more importance than ever. But this issue is like, wow, this is like the cosmic drama of the world, you know. And yeah, I mean, I hope that we reach, we hope that we get nearer that, you know. That's my inspiration, you know. How long will it take, you know, because it's been millennia, we've been on this for millennia, you know, and we've made a lot of achievements. We've won a lot of things, you know. In some cases, the world is fairer now. It's more just in some ways, but in other ways, so like the drama intensifies, you know. And yeah, but I hope so. You know, I'm also a lot into. I come from a permaculture background, and permaculture, for those who know about that. It's about ethics of building, more based on. It's not about software. It's about building houses and building systems in the world, plant, living, animal systems that are ethical to ourselves, to society, and to nature, you know, and which allow for a fair share, which allow for equality, for sharing, and for having decentralized and non-hierarchical systems, you know. But yeah, that's a huge question, man. Thanks for making it. So we have this like a milestone, you know, in which data becomes like the new oil. Wow, you know, this is huge. How does this work? Well, this is a little scheme in how this works. You know, first at the left we have, whenever you have you visit a website or you have an app in your phone, whatever, this has trackers, and these trackers send the info, the most as more info as they can collect, it's the better for them. And as more sensitive this info is, that's better. That's more monetizable. So nowadays, the main incentive for a developer to build an app or a website is not making it useful. It's more making it monetizable in the way that it collects sensitive information, and this information can be sold. You know, for example, I always give the example of a period tracker, of a woman fertile period tracker app. You know, that's very sensitive information because it's not only your period, it's also your moods, and that's very sensitive information. So it's very valuable for somebody who wants to use that info, you know, to affect you. Yes, I mean to influence you, yeah, to influence you maybe to buy what you don't need or to vote for you don't really would vote otherwise. But not only because of you, but because with your data, with your personal data, and with your neighbor's personal data and your cousin's personal data, and once you reach like 100, 1,000 people, then you can start having patterns, reading patterns, and extrapolate this info, and then you have like info about the whole world. You know, it's something that's also difficult to understand about this, which is the large scale this works. You know, some people say, I don't care about my data, you know, I don't have nothing to hide. You know, well, there's this Edward Snowden quote which says, just because you say you don't have nothing to hide, is, I mean, if you say you don't like or you don't approve the right to privacy because you don't have nothing to hide, it's like you don't approve the right to express, the freedom to express, because you don't have nothing to say. You know, it's a fundamental, privacy is a fundamental human right and freedom, you know. So, but the thing is not your personal privacy, you know. Yeah, it's an issue, my personal privacy, but the thing that worries us, that should worry us, is not our personal issue. It's that when you have a lot of personal privacy violated, when you have a lot of personal info, this builds like in a bigger picture that allows those who have this info to use it for manipulating. Is that manipulating? Is that a word in English? For influencing people into doing what the corporations want or the governments want. So this info is being sold, to their servers of the tracking companies. Then this goes into data exchange or data brokers, which buy info from these servers and sell them to maybe directly to advertisers or sometimes more to analytical consulting firms. Like Cambridge Analytica, we have one in Chile that helps the elections of that has helped the last elections in the side that won, which is called Smart Analytics, and then these companies sell this consultancy services to politics, for example, or to retail. Retail it's amazing for retail or for politics, you know. I'll give you some info later, but the ability to go directly to who you know could buy your product and without its neighbor, its spouse, without anybody else knowing what you are directly giving the info you are directly giving to this person is amazing. So I'll go kind of fast on this so we have some more time for chit chat and questions. Another concept that I try to bring into this language is the concept, there's this guy Marshall McLuhan, which is a very interesting writer, that his famous quote is, the medium is the message, in the sense that what's a medium? A medium is like any kind of technology, you know. A stick is a medium, a road is a medium to achieve something, And of course, the social network is a medium, television is in the medium. And he brings attention into not the, because we're usually, when we're talking about communication mediums like television, internet, telephone, whatsoever, radio, newspaper, we're usually focused on the content, you know. But he says, hey, wait a second, the content is important, but maybe more, maybe even more important than the content is the medium itself, because the medium has a specific format, has limitations, for example, in a newspaper, and the experience by which we interact with this medium, for example, if we read the newspaper, I don't know, in the morning, drinking coffee, seated with a specific physical posture, body posture, we watch TV in another body posture, maybe with people around, it's a passive attitude in which we have our eyes open and we are quiet. And this whole experience of every medium brings us, it's an experience in itself and brings us information, you know. In that sense, every new technological discovery goes like making new stages in this way, as the medium is the message. So as the medium transforms us as humans consuming this medium or interacting with this medium. So we have Felix says, if we allow surveillance because of convenience and marketing, in any case, governments will use it for control. It's already pretty much happening. Yeah, yeah, totally. So I think it's important to understand in the 20th century history, there's a big milestone, which is Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis, because if the concept of unconscious existed, at least from the 19th century, it is Sigmund Freud that first achieves a method for interacting or with this unconscious directly, you know. That's what makes psychoanalysis so great. So we have this unconscious, this part of our mind that we don't have direct access to it in everyday life, you know, but it affects us, the whole thing. We drive ourselves by our unconscious, mostly maybe in our lives. So and suddenly there's this way of trying to achieve this connection to the unconscious and to communicate with it and maybe to change some patterns that are there. So there's Edward Bernays, there's a great documentary called The Century of the Self, in which they explain this. Edward Bernays is a nephew of Sigmund Freud, which brings the knowledge of the psychoanalysis to America, to the United States, for being used in marketing and in politics also, influencing politics and electorals, I don't know how to say it. Well, you get the idea. And yeah, so he's basically he's, we are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested. And he sees they have the power of, and of well, as Hitler also did with propaganda, you know, the power of influencing people and molding their interests so they can buy or they can vote for whoever pays, this consultant in this case. There's also this series, I don't know if you've seen Mad Men, which is a very good example of this, about this marketing company in New York, Madison Avenue. So yeah, you start, you know, Santa Claus is a very good guy. If he smokes, then cigarettes can't be bad, you know. And sexy women, yeah, if you smoke, you'll get something good. So we'll skip a little. So then there's this Cambridge Analytica, which I just talked to you about, which is a very good example, because there's this documentary, The Great Hack, which talks about this and how the information gathered by Facebook was used to influence the Trump versus Clinton elections. So, yeah, this is happening, and this is, I think this, because it's not marketing, it's not just that you're buying things that you don't need, you know, this is like how do you say, what's the word, like affecting the very, the basis of democracy, you know? So, yeah, this is an example in, that was used in Chile, another company that works on surveillance capitalism, and this info is being used for affecting elections. This is just a snapshot of a consultancy company which does this. The title is in English, "Do you want to win the next elections?" So I think they changed it. I took this screenshot last year, but it's just like that. They offer this: "Do you want to win the next elections?" You know, so yeah. Elections always have been like a marketing war. That's ridiculous, you know. The guys who won are the guys who win are the guys who have the best marketing. But this could not be truer now than ever. So, there's also this guy Yanis Varoufakis, which is the finance minister of Greece, which I recommend. He's very clever and he has a language of explaining this. He talks about techno feudalism and he talks about this concept called the cloudalists. The cloudalists, like the capitalists of the cloud. We have it a video. I think Felix posted the big blue button on our PeerTube, in which have a selection of videos. And one of them is of Yanis Varoufakis. He talks about the algorithm, how the algorithm of social networks work, which is explained by also this documentary, The Social Dilemma. But both The Social Dilemma and the other documentary I talked about earlier, The Great Hack, which talked about the Cambridge Analytica thing, they both fail to address the real issue of the thing, because their solutions are like, The Social Dilemma solutions are, okay, let's regulate more. We should regulate more Facebook, you know. We should give them more regulations. So we need lawmakers to get more strict. And for me, that is not the solution, you know. The solution is not to talk about in a social network that is the property of one corporation that is driven by always driven by trying to get a greater margin and to get more money, because it's they try to it's on the stock market and all shareholders just want more money, and they will do whatever they can as long as the laws permit to gain more money, or even breaking the laws if the multa, if the punishment, the I forgot the word in English, well, if they have to pay just for breaking the law, they have to pay less than what they gained by breaking the law, you know. And this always happens. They move so big quantities of money. So yeah, the solution is not to regulate them more. I mean, great, let's regulate them more. But the solution is to build our future on decentralized platforms. The internet of the 90s, where I and maybe a lot of people here grew, was a decentralized platform, a free platform in which everybody was going to be able to talk with anybody and to publish any of their thoughts without depending on a newspaper or a TV channel, whatever, TV station. So, but the internet today and for most of millennials or new generations is based on three companies, you know. And we can't base our communications in a company, because a company will always look for their, what's the word? Well, it's not income, but to gain more money in a burden sense. So I think I will skip this part that I give to most people. I think it's very important for people to understand the difference between a source code and binary code, and how having binary code. I will just skip this because I think most of you people know about this, and if not, I recommend you to research about this and to give the importance why is it important to have a source code? Because if you don't have the source code of any software, And today your house is full of software, your watch, your vacuum cleaner, your smart cooking device, whatever, your computer, your smartphone, of course, they all have software. And if you don't have access to that source code, you have a robot inside your house that is programmed for something that you don't know what will do. So maybe it's programmed that for when it's the 13th of May and there's a storm, it will do explode, you know, whatever. You don't have a way of telling if you don't have the source code. So we should not allow for any robot or software inside our houses that we know we don't know the source code. You know, it's giving our freedom and giving our maybe it's dangerous, you know, giving everything to a company that maybe, even if they have like good ethical interests, that maybe they don't, because the main purpose of this company is, as I said, increasing their market value. But even if they have, they could commit mistakes, you know. So having this black box inside a house, that doesn't make any sense. There's something also important that I think is a very important concept in understanding this, which is this principle in economy called the principle of scarcity, which is a principle of material economy. You know, when we have a material economy, for example, bread, if I have one bread and I give, if I have two pieces of bread and I give one to you, then I'm left with only one piece of bread. You know, that's the principle of scarcity. If I give, I lose something. You know, it's in the material way, in the material world, it works like that. But in the information world, it doesn't work like that. I share information with you, and I don't lose it. You know, information has this capability of reproducing itself infinitely. So that emancipates the economy of information from the principle of scarcity. And that's very, for me, it's a key concept in understanding the economies of Libre software, you know. People ask, but how is it free? How will people, why will people then work on something that they won't get any revenue from? And they get a revenue. The thing is that the whole concept is different, you know, because it's based on collaboration. And with your betterment, with your enhancement of the software, I also do get plus, I get an extra, I get a better software, and we all share. And if we all share all the information, we all get better, you know. It works great. So that's this comic, you know, based on Jesus multiplicating the breads, you know. Anyone can do it with software. So,
Jose, I want to ask a question.
Go ahead.
So let you a little bit of water. My question was, and some people have been answering here in the chat, is about what do you think, you, Jose, all of us, we can do, like, right now with existing technology and knowledge to help our community or the whole world in this topic? What do you think we can do to help or to whatever you think we can do right now, like to help in this topic?
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, I didn't scroll to the chat, so I hadn't seen that question. So that is the whole question that I'm sharing with you, and I'm trying to share with you guys, to with everybody in with this talk. You know, how can we achieve like strategic planning in a worldwide community, Libre software community, to get more efficient in changing the world towards a world based on Libre software, you know? I use the term ethical platforms because it goes kind of beyond Libre software, in the sense that a lot of remote services not only need to be Libre software, but they also need another characteristics like a federation, for example, whatsoever, in order to be ethical, you know? But I think, I will, well, first of all, I think the building of a new language is important. You know, we need to have like a very well-defined and very fine way of expressing the importance, the urgency, and to reaching people in a way that makes sense to them. You know, this is not just a fanatical group of hippies or techies or nerds or hackers, whatever, you know. This is something that makes sense. So now there's something talking about AI. Yeah, now nowadays everybody's talking about AI. That's an opportunity for us. You know, we can say, people ask me, hey, what about AI? Is it good? Is it bad? You know, and the question is almost the same, you know. It's the same thing. It's, yeah, it's more software, you know. AI is not the problem. The problem is that we're giving away our power, we're giving away our freedom when we don't have access to source code, and when this software is for the benefit of a few corporations, you know. So first, yeah, but answering the question, I think first of all we need to build this language, and then, or I don't know if then, if later, but also I think we need, and I think the FSF could be and is maybe a great platform. I'm not very involved with it, but it's a great platform in which we can, for example, well, I was keeping this for later, but for example, the Freedom Ladder concept, which is a concept of the FSF, which is a very beautiful concept. It's a kind of an abstract concept in which you go towards software freedom by, as if you were climbing a stair, you know, and you make little steps, because when you give this info for people, few people say then, and when they understand it, maybe you, if you have the right language and you manage to reach these people emotionally, because at the end of the time, I think it's, yeah, it's also logical, but it's also an emotional thing. You get to move them. Okay, what then what do I do? And sometimes you don't know what to say, you know, you get, I don't know, replace Windows and install GNU Linux on your system. Okay, but who can help me do it? I can, but I'm living like 8,000 miles away from you. So there should be like a, I think we should kind of standardize, make a standard of steps, you know, like Freedom Ladder could be, for example, something very specific, you know, with different colors. For example, if we have the first color, red color, in which, I don't know, on your smartphone, you install F-Droid, which is this Libre software alternative to Google Play Store. Maybe then you get to use LibreOffice and use Open Document Standards, you know, that's another stage. Maybe, and to reach different stages, you go through different levels. So what if we give value to this? You know, we give value and you say, hey, as a personal level, you are at this stage and your next stage is this one, but maybe also at an institutional level. And that's where the power of community comes into place, because, for example, schools, I'm trying to target schools. We have this project, eticadigital.cl, in which we're trying to target specifically Waldorf schools, because I think Waldorf education schools can be more sensible to these issues. They have a whole thing towards freedom, and they are kind of small, mostly small projects that work with the power of community. So I'm trying to get this seed into them and to make a whole school to change. You know, if you make a whole school to change, that's a whole community. And it's not also a community, but it's also kids that will grow, you know, and then when they go out of school, they have these tools and they will look for Libre software. So I also think that the FSF has made a great effort in building, for example, these badges or graphical material, these videos. And I think all these videos and should maybe, could maybe be encompassed into a curriculum, you know, like we need ways, websites, or like one link to give people to where they can go through the whole thing, you know. I'm just like thinking out loud here, but yeah, those are my ideas. I think, for example, our mission in schools could be great. I'll jump because the question. I'll just jump. So there's these images of the of the FSF, you know, which are, I think, are very helpful, because these images build a language, you know, they build a language, they bring imaginary things into reality, you know, they express with an image, they express things that are difficult to express usually. So we have this project in which we are trying to build a seal of certification, like, you know, WWF, Care for the Forest, or organic foods, or bee companies, you know, seals, like, there, for example, in tourism, there are companies, consultants that certify you. If you have a tourism entrepreneur, or you have a tourism initiative, you know, and you have a good use of water, you don't you compost your organical dispose, you hire local people, blah blah blah. So these companies give you a seal. You are ethical tourism, great, or sustainable tourism, you know. We could have the same in software, you know. For example, a school, if they use Libre software and they use ethical platforms, you know, at different, maybe there's different levels. Maybe they can achieve bronze, they can achieve silver, they can achieve gold stage, in which you get certified, and this will give value. At a long term, it should give value to the school, and father or mother or whatever who has the children and wants to choose a school will say, hey, I prefer this school because this school has ethical software, you know, and ethical software certification. If they have ethical software certification, that means software is so important nowadays. You know, I want a school which has tackled this issue and which is not like omitting it, which is not like using it freely, let's use whatever things. No, it's tackling it, and it has the definitions, and it's using it responsibly. And there's not also, well, there's this thing about software, but there's also some other things. Like, I'm working with some doctors and teachers, and there's this whole, like, small children, as even if it's free software, Libre software, even if it's Libre software, when you're talking about little children, it can harm them. You know, there's a lot of studies, neurological studies, about the power of attention, about the damage in the eye, about a lot of things. Because there's this, even if it's Libre software, even if there's no algorithms, whatever, there's like how do you say, recompensa, reward, like a reward circuit that goes on your mind, and it's not good for the development of children. So that's beyond Libre software, but it should also be tackled by schools, I think. So that's one idea, you know. So it would be great if it is not just us in Chile doing this thing, you know, inventing, because we're just inventing this seal from nothing, you know, which is ética, which is ethic, but the K is like a check, you know, like you're approved. TI is technological information. So so it would be great if it's not just us in Chile. What if this seal is something that's worldwide, you know? And we have different schools worldwide which start to use it. And we have a curriculum for this. So we have a curriculum in the sense that we have different stages. So the schools uses LibreOffice, then the school uses whatever, bam, 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 bam. We have that could be based on the freedom ladder, you know? We could bring the freedom ladder and make these whole stages, this design this whole stage, and then not only by the software that the school uses, because that's administration of the school, that's one thing, but the other thing is, what about the curriculum of technology inside the school? You know, is the curriculum using Libre software, teaching with Libre software, and is the curriculum also, because it's so important, not just the technical things of software, but it's also important to educate children in the philosophical and sociological and political issues of software, you know. Is this being communicated also? Is this being talked about in the classroom when we're talking about software, or is software just a technical thing? So yeah, a little long my answer, but yeah, I jumped a little, so I think this is good. It was very good to jump to this part of the presentation. So do we have more questions, Hector?
Let us see. Some people are talking about, they are giving their points of view as well. For example, Jordan was saying that we like not buying things we don't need can be a way of helping, or another like option people were saying was like using transparent AI, using design thinking within the interdisciplinary teams. I think all these things or methodologies can help. And another thing, okay, yeah. Here, Jordan was saying like play or not playing. I'm not sure if shooting games at early age, maybe it's that can be like options. Like we can help because of the other people can like share their opinions as well or questions to participate. But there are no new questions as questions as como tal, digamos. That is all the questions that are right now, the questions or the opinions, like the people that are participating in the chat.
Yeah, so maybe now we can open the participation stage of this presentation, because I'm thinking there's one more thing that I can you hear me right? I'm on, yes. So so I just want to conclude with this. So there's this thing about people, most people can have a sense of security and privacy and the difference between these two things. But the thing is that the real issue for me is not, it's neither security nor privacy, you know, it's social resilience. I'm sorry, this is in Spanish. So it's social resilience because it's in the long term and in a big scale. You know, we're not talking, we're talking about security. It's important to have all your computer, your data secured, you know. It's also important to have privacy, which is a different thing, but it's related to security also. Without security, you don't have privacy. But more important than that is social resilience, you know, which has to do with democracy, which has to do with the right to privacy, which has to do with a free market free of monopolies, which has to do with libertad de expresión, freedom of speech, and it has to do with technological sustainability, you know, and that works in a long term and at a big scale. And that's why, and because it's thick, and it's because it's new, and because it's invisible, and all things that I said before, it's difficult to understand. So for me, the challenge is how can we explain this whole thing in just a few words with a very well-defined message, you know? So we now open the next stage in this presentation, in which everybody that's attending this presentation is free to unleash its own genius. So we all unleash our creative collective genius, and maybe something has rung a bell, maybe you have an idea right now, maybe I want people's ideas, please. So do you think of a language, do you think of something new that you think could help in bringing this message? Do you, or maybe you have an idea of how we could develop like strategic plannings for this? So please write. I don't know if we also could, Hector, maybe we could give people audio so they can ask or suggest their ideas directly.
can read what people is writing, because they are writing very good comments and ideas about what can be done. One second to drink a little bit of water. Let's see. For example, Michael is writing. He says, from a certification standpoint, there is a problem in that we can only verify what can be seen. He asks, how can you verify that the server is not violating ethics? He adds a little bit more that, yeah, you can verify published code according to Michael. Yeah, that is Michael's point of view, of course. He says you can verify published code, but you cannot verify the server is running the code that they publish. Do you agree with it? I think this is a very, very good question. Maybe with like computer science, very deep computer science knowledge, can we explain a little bit about this question? Yeah. It's very interesting, the question from Michael Mahano.
Yeah, I think, and he's talking with Felix. Felix gave the presentation last week about his software Lean Web for building static websites on this same channel. So yeah, and Felix is part of Ética Digital, and he's like the technical background of it. So yeah, we've seen like, and he's saying that we should also focus on professionals, because a lot of people that go to IT school, informatic technology, I don't know how to say that in English. So a lot of people get a lot of technical knowledge, but they don't get the ethical background of it. You know, they don't get the distinctions between ethical and non-ethical platforms. So I think we're like an early stage in software. You know, software is so new in humanity's history. So for example, in agriculture, we now have a stage in which we have organic agriculture, and we have sustainable agriculture and regenerative agriculture. And we have big corporation, pesticide-based, monocultures-based agriculture. And we know that it's not good, you know? So in software, we're just on a brand new stage in which we don't have that distinction. We have not asked ourselves yet, can software be ethical or not ethical, and what makes it ethical or non-ethical? So yeah, it's very important also to people that is working, you know, people that will become developers or web managers or whatsoever, to reach them somehow so they can have this distinction. So because a lot of people hire them to host or to build their software. And if they have this, because a lot of people that are people that don't have technical knowledge. So if they go to the technical guy and the technical guy then says, hey, I can give you this ethical solution, great, that's cool. Maybe it's easier to reach them because you don't have to add such a great background of technical info. But going to the question of Michael, you probably can't. I mean, Felix is talking about something like solid, which I don't know what is, but you probably can't. But what you can do is that you can certify. I mean, you will have to trust something. So for example, if the FSF has a server and the FSF has credibility and the FSF certifies a certain server, people will trust that server, you know? They won't be able to go or to see how the whole software and what is happening inside that server, but they will trust a trustable entity as the FSF. So that's the whole thing, you know, building trust. So, and in another way, yeah, and the most resilient solution will be, for example, once you reach a scale of a school, you can have your own server inside the school. maybe. You know, that's great. With all your cloud services inside, you can have Nextcloud, for example, which I think is a great solution nowadays for replacing Google Drive and Google Calendar and Gmail, and which are most of the people, all of the services people use. And yeah, it's great. Nextcloud has been growing a lot the last years. I think it's a very solid piece of software. I like it. I use it a lot. And I propose it to schools. You can have your own instance of Fediverse network, like Mastodon, PixelFed, whatever. You can have your own PeerTube server. You can have maybe an Matrix or an IRC server or whatever. So inside, and that's a great opportunity for schools, as it is also a source of, I mean, it's an opportunity for learning, you know, because students, when you have high school students, I mean, the whole curriculum of a year could be building the server and hosting the software there, you know, and hosting the software for the school, you know, and the whole circle starts to close and it makes sense. So the conversation still goes.
Another question to help you with the reading, so you can rest a little bit your throat. That is the answer for Michael. Yeah, that is very, very good question. Another people are like adding a little bit servers programmed not to only help human. I don't get very well to rephrase that from Jordan. Felix says you could verify they have their own installation or use stuff like Solid. Okay, Solid.
Sorry, let me, if it's okay, I can interrupt you guys for a second.
Yes, come on.
So basically what I had mentioned about programs only being helpful for humans, basically they say that AIs don't have emotions, but they're built off us by programming them. So basically if someone probably is in the view or is basically writing the code, the AI should be able to segregate the difference between making it bad for the human, not ethical, versus ethical, is maybe probably a good way of like everyone's trying to explain, of trying to evaluate the decentralization of the AI. If that makes any sense, if I'm clear in what I'm trying to say.
So, I mean, yeah, but it goes kind of subjective, right? So.
It is, and also what Felix had mentioned as well is people have to basically be in that position. So if there's, I'm assuming, they have to look into that, just having certain courses, programs that relate to a lot of overall ethical situations of world life, then at that point, that person or that, or he or she should be put in that position, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but we're talking about the Michael's original question, which was that you can't tell if what's happening inside a server remotely, right?
And I was assuming that Michael was talking about mostly as a server were to go bad and start acting on its own, just like in the metaverse. So all of a sudden we start having like zombies start showing up in the metaverse, and it's the server that's causing the situation, because either someone had put a program inside of it to cause that situation. I feel that at that point we should, or it should have restrictions on what is right for humans and what should humans even go far to learn / program into any of these programs.
So I think first we could make a distinction between ethical in the sense that we need some ethical basis for any software, which is that it should give power to the people that use it, and that's then we're based in the four freedoms of libre software, and then when we're talking about remote services or we're talking about systems that are not centralized in the sense that they will give resilience to people to being able to use it and not depend on a centralized. And then that I think is what you mean is the ethical, what specifically does the software then? So the software has to comply with all these characteristics that I just gave, but then the software has a purpose, you know? And then what's the purpose of this software? Is that ethical or not? Is that what you were meaning?
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually what I mean. It's basically if it's ethical or not, the server knows whether or not it's ethical or not. It can be decentralized. There still has to be a control over every server / free software has to be shown into every education so that people can make their, like anything, patents or new programs, new softwares, even if a young kid had hacked into, like, say, Google or something, all this stuff needs to happen. It's not something where we can just stop it and say, okay, we need to stop it right now. Those little things have to happen in order for us to fix these problems.
Okay. I don't know what else to say.
Maybe I can rephrase or maybe repeat a little bit of what Jordan was saying, or from what I understand of Jordan.
Okay, please, go ahead.
And another point of view. One main point, I couldn't follow everything, but the main point that I understand and that I agree as well is that the ethics or everything should be programmed to help the humans with ethics. I think that is the one point that Jordan was saying, and I think it is a very good point. Because ethics is very fundamental. That is my understanding of the question or of the comment of Jordan. Yeah, I'm very happy of all the people right now participating, giving their opinion, their questions, their solutions, their point of view. It's very nice to have all these comments. Because we all can grow, because we all are seeing the answers. Yeah, it's not that only one is seeing the answers, but everyone, like the speakers and the assistants, are seeing the answers, and all can grow with this knowledge, this collective knowledge. Another comment from Jordanis. He says, thumbs up for focusing on children. We must see these ideas, especially to younger ages. Young kids are more vulnerable as they grow up with the current technology in their hands. I think it's a very good comment. Yeah, to be conscious. Yeah. What can you add, Jose?
I mean, I'm a father of five, and and computers have always been a reality in my life. So, I've taught them to program at some age, but I think, for example, I have a 9 and a 5 year old, and And I'm trying to get them as off as possible from screens yet. So I think there are some principles with, and this should be incorporated into a school technical education, technological education curriculum, in which you can start to teach things that have to do with digital technology before having a screen, before getting the child to screen. You can teach some programming basics, rudimentaries. You can teach some math about binary numbers. You can teach sociological issues, you know, history. You have to teach a lot of things. And then once, I don't know, I should say 12 years, you know, I will try to my small children maybe to wait until 12 years. Of course, they have relations with screens every now and then anyway, but at 12 years old, I think it's a good age to get them to the computer and start working, start learning, you know. And then I think that there should be different stages. I think just as the history of computer goes, they should first learn some mechanics, you know, before electrics, and then electronics, and logics, and syllogistic, and then digital. And then when they go digital, which start with a black screen terminal, probably, you know, in which they give they type in commands, and they should learn, they should have the first experiences. This is my own personal opinion, you know, but I think that they should have their first programming experiences by typing into this shell, and then you get to move to the mouse or to a graphical environment, and then later you get to move to a touch based, you know, because it's like higher levels. And well, before access to the software directly, maybe you should learn a little about the hardware, you know. So I should go very gradually, you know, and that they, once they reach a level, they have they have knowledge about the levels that go behind that. But I hate maybe when you go to a coffee shop or whatever and there's these parents and the children is just holding the phone and looking at the phone, or maybe in a market, you know, the parents going and the children is always looking at the phone and looking at the phone. Yeah, for me that is not good at all, you know, and it's go way beyond Libre software. It goes to another level of issues, you know, that also some are debatable, some are very well researched, but it goes into neurological issues, it goes into social issues, psychological issues. So yeah. Yeah, and we're reaching our hour and a half supposed deadline for this presentation. So I think we're good. I don't know if there are more questions. Well, we didn't have much suggestions of new language, but I'm in my contact. I don't know if it's on the website, but you can go to eticadigital.cl, and you can write us there. There's this hola at eticadigital.cl, hola at eticadigital.cl. There's geoma.casa. Also a website in which I tried last year. I wrote a lot before starting the Ética Digital initiative. I started writing about what I thought was something that people didn't know about all these issues, and how to, my recommendations to migrate from dystopian platforms to ethical ones and other things. So please, I am very open to be contacted, people who resonates with this knowledge, or maybe people who like the idea of the certification and has contacts with schools. And I would love this idea of certification to work and to work in a more global level. So, do we have more questions?
Yeah, somebody can talk as well, or I can read Continue reading from where we left. Anybody can interrupt me at any time. Yeah, I just go.
In the IRC, in the Libre Planet IRC channel, there's BKM who's asking, should there be IT ethics certifications or qualifications? Older fields such as nursing, medicine, engineering, etc., typically have decent professional qualifications. This is another idea, you know. This goes beyond what I proposed, and this is also a very interesting idea, you know. How to bring IT ethics for this, how to bring an ethics certification to IT training or to IT education. And it has to do with what Felix recently said. So, and then, yeah, Felix just typed in the different contacts we have in the IRC channel. Yeah, so, I mean, it's a very good idea. I'm not particularly close to IT education, but I think it's great, and maybe it could also use, I mean, it has to have, it's a different plan. It's a different thing from what I was talking about certifying schools or institutions, you know, it's a whole different thing. But maybe it could use the same language that we grabbed from this idea of using the freedom ladder, you know. Maybe you could apply the freedom ladder to schools certification system. You could also apply the freedom ladder to an institutions, enterprises, whatever certification system, and you could also apply this freedom ladder to an IT education ethics certification, maybe to other also fields, you know. It would be lovely. I would love to see a system in which the freedom ladder is FSF Freedom Ladder certification system, and for all these areas. It's a lot of work, you know, it's a lot of work. So we have to go slow and steady, but I think that having a worldwide community around this could give us great advantage. More questions, comments?
I would like to add as well to the certification in ethics that was the original question, that for example in many countries like IT or it is an engineering field, yeah, and as an engineers it should have like the ethics of all engineers. In other countries, it is like computer science, it's sort of like scientific. But at least, for example, in many Latin American countries, that is my knowledge, it is computer engineering or IT engineering or software engineering. They treat as like general engineering, and they should have ethics. Of course, there is room to improve it, and improve it, putting those concepts of the ladder that Jose was talking from the Free Software Foundation, that can be a good, very good adding, I think. That was my addition.
Great.
Yeah. Continuing with the comments, Jordan is as well. It's about the children. He mentions a very important thing here. He says, he believes the passive acceptance of the current situation. Yeah. Passive acceptance, very, very good combination of words, of the current situation. It's like a virus affecting the mentality of humans. Yeah, and which gives a, is what do you, what can you add, Jose, about the passive acceptance of the current situation? Because I think it's very, very good point of what everything, well, what everything that happens in the whole world in any year or any century of any millennia is probably because of that, maybe. What do you think about the passive acceptance?
Yeah, I think this also goes way beyond software and technology. This goes like it's like a social issue, and I think I mean somebody benefits from this. You know there's this phrase bread and circus. You know, give the people bread and circus, give the people basic food needs and entertainment. Like soccer, for example, and you can have like people passively accepting abuses, and it's kind of huge, and I think we're building a kind of a way out of this through our little grains of sand that we specifically collaborate on software freedom. And this also goes in a lot of other human and social areas. So in ecology and mind development and spiritual development and in political issues, I know it goes. And yeah, young children, I mean, education is basic, you know. Schools have been, I think, historically a way of consolidating a mindset and of keeping specific mindsets that benefit the elite or the corporations and keep this mindset going on, you know. So yeah, that's why I'm mainly focusing on schools. I think it's the most fertile area to plant these seeds. Noemu is saying, I'm organizing learning circles to discuss education in regards to freely licensed software and resources, culturally relevant curriculum, and intersectional analysis. Seems like people here might be interested. More info here, and he gives a link. Maybe somebody could share this link on the IRC so people that are following us on IRC could also have access to it. Yeah, it sounds very interesting. I'll check this sooner today, also later today. And there was also a question from in IRC from a while ago from CCCAAAMMM. It says, I think that the problem is, I think, in make communities of free software instead of making or joining communities not related to free software and offer free software to resolve their actual existence tech needs. If I understand this okay, I think he refers to, I mean, for example, we're in Mastodon, and I'm in Mastodon, I'm in PixelFed, I'm in CalcKey also, I'm in Libre Federated social networks that are part of the Fediverse. I had an Instagram account like some years ago, and I decided to close it. But the thing right now, as Felix says, we're resonating in our own echo chamber. So everybody in Mastodon, I mean, well, recently Mastodon has grown a lot. We're like reaching 12 million users now, thanks in part to the Twitter exodus that has occurred in the last year. But it has always been like everybody who always knows about these subjects is there. So we keep talking about the good things about Libre software and the dangers of proprietary software. Yeah, but we already know that, you know, we're inside the same community. And how can we reach people outside of that? And I think that's very important, you know, and we have to choose wisely, because first, maybe the most wise decision could be to leave Instagram, to leave Google, to leave all these networks. And that's great, you know, it gives you freedom. But then suddenly you can't reach anybody, you know, and you can't get your message. If you have a message that has importance and you have some knowledge that needs to be shared with people, you can't reach them. I have in my website one post that's called Recommendations for Migration. Do not delete your Instagram account yet, but in Spanish. And I talk about the subject, you know, and I say, yeah, maybe it's good to have an Instagram account for a while in which you can give this message to people and then alert people and say, hey, guys, in 1 month I'm leaving Instagram. You can still follow me at PixelFed or at Mastodon, and or whatever, Friendic, Pletoma, whatever. And then you keep saying why, and you keep posting about the dangers of proprietary software, blah blah blah. And then when you reach the day, the final day, you say, okay, this is my last day here. If you want to keep talking with me, please let's see us in Mastodon. And then you invoke the power of your absence, which can only be invoked once. And when you invoke that power and you disappear from Instagram or Facebook or whatever, you make people open new accounts in Mastodon because they want to be in contact with you, you know? And that starts creating an effect, like a domino reaction. And then we hope that each one of these people that followed you to an ethical network does the same, you know, keeps themselves for a while in the dystopian network, but helping others understand why this network is not good for themselves nor for society, until they finally invoke the power of their absence, delete their Instagram account, but not just deleting it, like, I'm just going to delete everything. No, you have an account, used wisely, you know, give the message. Say you're leaving, say where you're leaving, how can they follow you, why are you leaving, you know, and then you help migrate. Felix there just posted the link to the article I was talking about. It's like entertaining because I use some tarot archetypes and some other things.
Excellent comment about that. Towards power of absence, yeah, because if people doesn't know you, they don't know that you exist. But if you show what you know, what you have, like in widely known networks, as Jose says, it's a good strategy, a very, very good strategy to make people go to other networks that respect privacy, that are ethic, that are distributed, which are concepts, very important concepts. I think it is a very good strategy from Jose to have shared with us that strategy and that power of absence. Yeah, that when that is that when you are there, it can be in a job as well. You are there, and things work. But when you are not there, anything starts to fail, and you say, "Oh, maybe this guy was doing something important. Maybe, yeah." And that is a very good concept that you have put this towards there, Jose. I don't know if you think it's a good time to end, because there are many links that is still what you think, Jose. I don't know if there are more questions. Let's see.
Felix just wrote about David Rivoy, which is this artist, and he quitted. He just sent a link. He quitted Twitter and joined Mastodon. He first joined Mastodon and then quit Twitter. And he wrote something that seems interesting about that, like a strategies for for migration and for making mass migrations, I think. Yeah, I'll check it out. I'll read it.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, I think people want like a wrap up to finish. I think it's been great to have all these questions, all the discussion, all the participation of the people, all the concepts brought by Jose, his passion for what he does. It's been very, very enriching to all of us. On behalf of the organizers, I want to thank Jose for his participation. I want to thank all the participants for the participation as well. We should continue talking, discussing, and now we need to have a lunch right now. Yeah, I think it's a very good topic. We should keep working from each one from their sides. Can help, as many have mentioned it here. Again, thank you very much, Jose, for your talk.
Thanks to everybody. Thanks, Hector, for hosting. Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Greg, and thanks to Jean and Miriam, which helped me through the email to make this a reality, to every organizer of Libre Planet and all the people, all the team behind the FSF. Thanks for your excellent and great work you've guys been doing for years. So yeah, it's an honor to me. I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for having the confidence, for trusting me and in hosting us this presentation. And yeah, thanks to everybody who attended this. Hope you had a good time. Hope this helps us build a better Libre software and ethical software future for humanity. Thank you very much. Feel free to contact me. Thank you.